such absurdity was commonplace. Bobard used to say, "Take two Afghans who've never met, put them in a room for 10 minutes, and they'll figure out how they're related." We left the old man on the steps of that building. I meant to take him up on his offer, to come back and see if he had unearthed any more stories about my mother. But I never saw him again. We found the new orphanage in the northern part of Kartese, along the banks of the dried-up Kabul River. It was a flat, barrack-style building with splintered walls and windows boarded with planks of wood. Farid had told me on the way there that Kartese had been one of the most war-ravaged neighborhoods in Kabul, and as we stepped out of the truck, the evidence was overwhelming. The cratered streets were flanked by little more than ruins of shelled buildings and abandoned homes. We passed the rusted skeleton of an overturned car, a TV set with no screen, half buried in rubble, a wall with the words "Zindabad Taliban," "Long live the Taliban," sprayed in black. A short, thin, balding man with a shaggy gray beard opened the door. He wore a ragged tweed jacket, a skull cap, and a pair of eyeglasses with one chipped lens resting on the tip of his nose. Behind the glasses, tiny eyes like black peas flitted from me to Farid. "Salaam alaikum," he said. "Salaam alaikum," I said. I showed him the Polaroid. "We're searching for this boy." He gave the photo a cursory glance. "I'm sorry, I've never seen him." "You barely looked at the picture, my friend," Farid said. "Why not take a closer look?" "Lutfan," I added, "please." The man behind the door took the picture, studied it, handed it back to me. "Nay, sorry. I know just about every single child in this institution, and that one doesn't look familiar. If you'll permit me, I have work to do." He closed the door, locked the bolt. I rapped on the door with my knuckles. Oh, please open the door. We don't mean him any harm." "I told you, he's not here." His voice came from the other side. "Now please go away." Farid stepped up to the door and rested his forehead on it. "Friend, we're not with the Taliban," he said in a low, cautious voice. "The man who is with me wants to take this boy to a safe place." "I come from Peshawar," I said. "A good friend of mine knows an American couple there who run a charity home for children." I felt the man's presence on the other side of the door. I sensed him standing there, listening, hesitating, caught between suspicion and hope. "Look, I knew Sohrab's father," I said. "His name was Hassan. His mother's name was Farzona. He called his grandmother Sasa. He knows how to read and write, and he's good with the slingshot. There's hope for this boy, Aga, a way out. Please open the door." From the other side, only silence. "I'm his half-uncle," I said. A moment passed. Then a key rattled in the lock. The man's narrow face reappeared in the crack. He looked from me to Farid and back. "You were wrong about one thing," he said. "What?" "He's great with the slingshot." I smiled. "He's inseparable from that thing," he said. "He tucks it in the waist of his pants everywhere he goes." The man who let us in introduced himself as Zaman, the director of the orphanage. "I'll take you to my office," he said. We followed him through dim, grimy hallways where barefoot children dressed in frayed sweaters ambled around. We walked past rooms with no floor covering but matted carpets and windows shuttered with sheets of plastic. Skeleton frames of steel beds, most with no mattress, filled the rooms. "How many orphans live here?" Farid said. "More than we have room for. About 250, Zaman said over his shoulder. "But they're not all yatim. Many of them have lost their fathers in the war, and their mothers can't feed them because the Taliban don't allow them to work. So they bring their children here." He made a sweeping gesture with his hand and added ruefully, "This place is better than the street, but not that much better." This building was never meant to be lived in. It used to be a storage warehouse for a carpet manufacturer. So there's no water heater, and they've let the well go dry. He dropped his voice. I've asked the Taliban for money to dig a new well more times than I remember, and they just twirl their rosaries and tell me there's no money. No money, he snickered. He pointed to a row of beds along the wall. We don't have enough beds and not enough mattresses for the beds we do have. Worse, we don't have enough blankets. He showed us a little girl skipping rope with two other kids. You see that girl? This past winter, the children had to share blankets. Her brother died of exposure. He walked on. The last time I checked, we have less than a month's supply of rice left in the warehouse, and when that runs out, the children will have to eat bread and tea for breakfast and dinner. I noticed he made no mention of lunch. He stopped and turned to me. There is very little shelter here, almost no food, no clothes, and no clean water. What I have in ample supply here is children who have lost their childhood. But the tragedy is that these are the lucky ones. We're filled beyond capacity, and every day I turn away mothers who bring their children. He took a step toward me. You say there is hope for Sohrab? I pray you don't lie, Aura. But you may well be too late. What do you mean? I said. Zaman's eyes shifted. Follow me. What passed for the director's office was four bare cracked walls, a mat on the floor, a table, and two folding chairs. As Zaman and I sat down, I saw a gray rat poke its head from a burrow in the wall and flit across the room. I cringed when it sniffed at my shoes, then Zaman's, and scurried through the open door. What did you mean, it may be too late? I said. Would you like some choy? I could make some, he said. Nay, thank you. I'd rather we just talk. Zaman tilted back in his chair and crossed his arms on his chest. What I have to tell you is not pleasant, not to mention that it may be very dangerous. For whom? I said. You, me, and of course for Sohrab, if it's not too late already. I need to know, I said. He nodded. So you say. But first, I want to ask you a question. How badly do you want to find your nephew? I thought of the street fights we would get into when we were kids. All the times Hassan used to take them on for me, two against one, sometimes three against one. I would wince and watch, tempted to step in, but always stopping short, always held back by something. I looked at the hallway and saw a group of kids dancing in a circle. A little girl, her left leg amputated below the knee, sat on a ratty mattress and watched, smiling and clapping along with the other children. I saw Farid watching the children too, his own mangled hand hanging at his side. I remembered Wahid's boys, and I realized something. I would not leave Afghanistan without finding Sohrab. Tell me where he is, I said. Zaman's gaze lingered on me. Then he nodded, picked up a pencil, and twirled it between his fingers. Keep my name out of it. I promise, I said. He tapped the table with the pencil. Despite your promise, I think I will live to regret this. But perhaps it's just as well. I'm damned anyway. But if something can be done for Sohrab, I'll tell you because I believe you. You have the look of a desperate man. He was quiet for a long time. There is a Talib official, he muttered. He visits once every month or two. He brings cash with him, not a lot, but better than nothing at all. His shifty eyes fell on me, rolled away. Usually, he'll take a girl, but not always. And you allow this? Farid said behind me. He was going around the table, closing in on Zaman. What choice do I have? Zaman shot back. He pushed himself away from the desk. You're the director here, Farid said. Your job is to watch over these children. There's nothing I can do to stop it, Zaman said. You're selling children, Farid barked. Farid, sit down, let it go, I said. But I was too late, because suddenly Farid was leaping over the table. Zaman's chair went flying as Farid fell on him and pinned him to the floor. The director thrashed beneath Farid and made muffled screaming sounds. His legs kicked the desk drawer free and sheets of paper spilled to the floor. I ran around the desk and saw why Zaman's screaming was muffled. Farid was strangling him. I grasped Farid's shoulders with both hands and pulled hard. He snatched away from me. "That's enough!" I barked. But Farid's face had flushed red, his lips pulled back to a snarl. "I'm killing him! You can't stop me! I'm killing him!" he sneered. "Get off him!" I said. "I'm killing him!" Something in his voice told me that if I didn't do something quickly, I would witness my first murder. "The children are watching, Farid. They're watching," I said. His shoulder muscles tightened under my grip, and for a moment, I thought he would keep squeezing Zaman's neck anyway. Then he turned around, saw the children. They were standing silently by the door, holding hands, some of them crying. I felt Farid's muscles slacken. He dropped his hands, rose to his feet. He looked down on Zaman and dropped a mouthful of spit on his face. Then he walked to the door and closed it. Zaman struggled to his feet, blotted his bloody lips with his sleeve, wiped the spit off his cheek. Coughing and wheezing, he put on his skullcap, his glasses, saw both lenses had cracked, and took them off. He buried his face in his hands. None of us said anything for a long time. "He took Sohrab a month ago," Zaman finally croaked, hands still shielding his face. "You call yourself a director?" Farid said. Zaman dropped his hands. "I haven't been paid in over 6 months. I'm broke because I've spent my life savings on this orphanage. Everything I ever owned or inherited, I sold to run this godforsaken place. You think I don't have family in Pakistan and Iran? I could have run like everyone else, but I didn't. I stayed. I stayed because of them." He pointed to the door. "If I deny him one child, he takes 10. So I let him take one and leave the judging to Allah. I swallow my pride and take his goddamn filthy, dirty money. Then I go to the bazaar and buy food for the children." Farid dropped his eyes. "What happens to the children he takes?" I asked. Zaman rubbed his eyes with his forefinger and thumb. "Sometimes they come back," he said. "Who is he? How do we find him?" I said. "Go to Qazi Stadium tomorrow. You'll see him at halftime. He'll be the one wearing black sunglasses." He picked up his broken glasses and turned them in his hands. "I want you to go now. The children are frightened." He escorted us out. As the truck pulled away, I saw Zaman in the side view mirror, standing in the doorway. A group of children surrounded him, clutching the hem of his loose shirt. I saw he had put on his broken glasses. We crossed the river and drove north through the crowded Pashtunistan square. Baba used to take me to Khaybar restaurant there for kebab. The building was still standing, but its doors were padlocked, the windows shattered, and the letters K and R missing from its name. I saw a dead body outside the restaurant. There had been a hanging. A young man dangled from the end of a rope tied to a beam, his face puffy and blue, the clothes he had worn on the last day of his life shredded, bloody. Hardly anyone seemed to notice him. We rode silently through the square and headed toward the Wazir Akbar Khan district. Everywhere I looked, a haze of dust covered the city and its sun-dried brick buildings. A few blocks north of Pashtunistan Square, Farid pointed to two men talking animatedly at a busy street corner. One of them was hobbling on one leg, his other leg amputated below the knee. He cradled an artificial leg in his arms. "You know what they're doing? Haggling over the leg," Farid said. "He's selling his leg?" Farid nodded. "You can get good money for it on the black market. It'll feed your kids for a couple of weeks." To my surprise, most of the houses in the Wazir Akbar Khan district still had roofs and standing walls. In fact, they were in pretty good shape. Trees still peeked over the walls, and the streets weren't nearly as rubble-strewn as the ones in Kartese. Faded street signs, some twisted and bullet-pocked, still pointed the way. "This isn't so bad," I remarked.
"No surprise," Farid said. "Most of the important people live here now."
"The Taliban?" I asked.
"Them too," he said.
"Who else?" He drove us into a wide street with fairly clean sidewalks and walled homes on either side.
"The people behind the Taliban, the real brains of this government, if you can call it that. Arabs, Chechens, Pakistanis," Farid said.
He pointed northwest. "Street 15, that way, is called Sarak-e-Mehmana, Street of the Guests. That's what they call him here, guests. I think someday these guests are going to pee all over the carpet."
"I think that's it," I said. "Over there."
I pointed to the landmark that used to serve as a guide for me when I was a kid.
"If you ever get lost," Baba used to say, "remember that our street is the one with the pink house at the end of it."
The pink house with the steeply pitched roof had been the neighborhood's only house of that color in the old days. It still was. Farid turned onto the street. I saw Baba's house right away. We find the little turtle behind tangles of sweetbriar in the yard. We don't know how it got there, and we're too excited to care. We paint its shell a bright red, Hassan's idea, and a good one. This way, we'll never lose it in the bushes. We pretend we're a pair of daredevil explorers who have discovered a giant prehistoric monster in some distant jungle, and we've brought it back for the world to see. We set it down in the wooden wagon Ali built Hassan last winter for his birthday, and pretend it's a giant steel cage. Behold the fire-breathing monstrosity. We march on the grass and pull the wagon behind us, around apple and cherry trees which become skyscrapers soaring into clouds, heads poking out of thousands of windows to watch the spectacle passing below. We walk over the small garden bridge Baba has built near a cluster of fig trees. It becomes a great suspension bridge joining cities, and the little pond below, a foamy sea. Fireworks explode above the bridge's massive pylons, and armed soldiers salute us on both sides as gigantic steel cables shoot to the sky. The little turtle bouncing around in the cab, we drag the wagon around the circular red brick driveway outside the wrought iron gates and return the salutes of the world's leaders as they stand and applaud. We are Hassan and Amir, famed adventurers and the world's greatest explorers, about to receive a Medal of Honor for our courageous feat. Gingerly, I walked up the driveway where tufts of weed now grew between the sun-faded bricks. I stood outside the gates of my father's house, feeling like a stranger. I set my hands on the rusty bars, remembering how I had run through these same gates thousands of times as a child, for things that mattered not at all now, and yet had seemed so important then. I peered in. The driveway extension that led from the gates to the yard, where Hassan and I took turns falling the summer we learned to ride a bike, didn't look as wide or as long as I remembered it. The asphalt had split in a lightning streak pattern, and more tangles of weed sprouted through the fissures. Most of the poplar trees had been chopped down, the trees Hassan and I used to climb to shine our mirrors into the neighbors' homes. The ones still standing were nearly leafless. The wall of ailing corn was still there, though I saw no corn, ailing or otherwise, along that wall now. The paint had begun to peel and sections of it had sloughed off altogether. The lawn had turned the same brown as the haze of dust hovering over the city, dotted by bald patches of dirt where nothing grew at all. A jeep was parked in the driveway, and that looked all wrong. Baba's black Mustang belonged there. For years, the Mustang's eight cylinders roared to life every morning, rousing me from sleep. I saw that oil had spilled under the jeep, a
and stained the driveway like a big Rorschach inkblot. Beyond the Jeep, an empty wheelbarrow lay on its side. I saw no sign of the rose bushes that Baba and Ali had planted on the left side of the driveway, only dirt that spilled onto the asphalt, and weeds. Farid honked twice behind me. "We should go, Aga, we'll draw attention," he called. "Just give me one more minute," I said. The house itself was far from the sprawling white mansion I remembered from my childhood. It looked smaller. The roof sagged and the plaster was cracked. The windows to the living room, the foyer, and the upstairs guest bathroom were broken, patched haphazardly with sheets of clear plastic or wooden boards nailed across the frames. The paint, once a sparkling white, had faded to a ghostly gray and eroded in parts, revealing the layered bricks beneath. The front steps had crumbled. Like so much else in Kabul, my father's house was the picture of fallen splendor. I found the window to my old bedroom, second floor, third window south of the main steps to the house. I stood on tiptoes and saw nothing behind the window but shadows. 25 years earlier, I had stood behind that same window, thick rain dripping down the panes and my breath fogging up the glass. I had watched Hassan and Ali load their belongings into the trunk of my father's car. "Amir Agha," Farid called again. "I'm coming," I shot back. Insanely, I wanted to go in. I wanted to walk up the front steps where Ali used to make Hassan and me take off our snow boots. I wanted to step into the foyer, smell the orange peel Ali always tossed into the stove to burn with sawdust, sit at the kitchen table, have tea with a slice of naan, and listen to Hassan sing old Hazara songs. Another honk. I walked back to the Land Cruiser parked along the sidewalk. Farid sat smoking behind the wheel. "I have to look at one more thing," I told him. "Can you hurry?" he said. "Give me 10 minutes. "Go then," he said. Then, just as I was turning to go, "Just forget it all. Makes it easier." "To what?" I said. "To go on," Farid said. He flicked a cigarette out of the window. "How much more do you need to see? Let me save you the trouble. Nothing that you remember has survived. Best to forget." "I don't want to forget anymore," I said. "Give me 10 minutes. We hardly broke a sweat, Hassan and I, when we hiked up the hill just north of Baba's house. We scampered about the hilltop chasing each other or sat on a sloped ridge where there was a good view of the airport in the distance. We would watch airplanes take off and land, go running again. Now, by the time I reached the top of the craggy hill, each ragged breath felt like inhaling fire. Sweat trickled down my face. I stood wheezing for a while, a stitch at my side. Then I went looking for the abandoned cemetery. It didn't take me long to find it. It was still there. And so was the old pomegranate tree. I leaned against the gray stone doorway to the cemetery where Hassan had buried his mother. The old metal gates hanging off the hinges were gone, and the headstones were barely visible through the thick tangles of weeds that had claimed the plot. A pair of crows sat on the low wall that enclosed the cemetery. Hassan had said in his letter that the pomegranate tree had not borne fruit in years. Looking at the wilted, leafless tree, I doubted it ever would again. I stood under it, remembered all the times we had climbed it, straddled its branches, our legs swinging, dappled sunlight flickering through the leaves and casting on our faces a mosaic of light and shadow. The tangy taste of pomegranate crept into my mouth. I hunkered down on my knees and brushed my hands against the trunk. I found what I was looking for. The carving had dulled, almost faded altogether, but it was still there. Amir and Hassan, the sultans of Kabul. I traced the curve of each letter with my fingers, picked small bits of bark from the tiny crevices. I sat cross-legged at the foot of the tree and looked south on the city of my childhood. In those days, treetops poked behind the walls of every house. The sky stretched wide and blue, and laundry drying on clotheslines glimmered in the sun. If you listened hard, you might have even heard the call of the fruit seller passing through Wazir Akbar Khan with his donkey. Cherries! Apricots! Grapes! In the early evening, you would have heard Azan, the muezzin's call to prayer from the mosque in Shahr-e-Now. I heard a honk and saw Farid waving at me. It was time to go. We drove south again, back toward Pashtunistan Square. We passed several more red pickup trucks with armed, bearded young men crammed into the cabs. Farid cursed under his breath every time we passed one. I paid for a room at a small hotel near Pashtunistan Square. Three little girls, dressed in identical black dresses and white scarves, clung to the slight, bespectacled man behind the counter. He charged me $75, an unthinkable price given the rundown appearance of the place, but I did not mind. Exploitation to finance a beach house in Hawaii was one thing. Doing it to feed your kids was another. There was no hot running water, and the cracked toilet did not flush. Just a single steel frame bed with a worn mattress, a ragged blanket, and a wooden chair in the corner. The window overlooking the square had broken and hadn't been replaced. As I lowered my suitcase, I noticed a dried bloodstain on the wall behind the bed. I gave Farid some money and he went out to get food. He returned with four sizzling skewers of kebab, fresh naan, and a bowl of white rice. We sat on the bed and all but devoured the food. There was one thing that hadn't changed in Kabul after all. The kebab was as succulent and delicious as I remembered. That night, I took the bed and Farid lay on the floor. He wrapped himself with an extra blanket for which the hotel owner charged me an additional fee. No light came into the room except for the moonbeam streaming through the broken window. Farid said the owner had told him that Kabul had been without electricity for 2 days now, and his generator needed fixing. We talked for a while. Farid told me about growing up in Mazar-e-Sharif, in Jalalabad. He told me about a time shortly after he and his father joined the jihad and fought the Shorawi in the Panjshir Valley. They were stranded without food and ate locusts to survive. He told me of the day helicopter gunfire killed his father, of the day the landmine took his two daughters. He asked me about America. I told him that in America, you could step into a grocery store and buy any of 15 or 20 different types of cereal. The lamb was always fresh and the milk cold, the fruit plentiful and the water clear. Every home had a TV and every TV a remote, and you could get a satellite dish if you wanted. Receive over 500 channels. 500, Farid exclaimed. 500, I said. We fell silent for a while. Just when I thought he had fallen asleep, Farid chuckled. Aha, did you hear what Mullah Nasruddin did when his daughter came home and complained that her husband had beaten her? I could feel him smiling in the dark, and a smile of my own formed on my face. There wasn't an Afghan in the world who didn't know at least a few jokes about the bumbling mullah. What? I said. He beat her too, then sent her back to tell the husband that mullah was no fool. If the bastard was going to beat his daughter, then mullah would beat his wife in return. I laughed, partly at the joke, partly at how Afghan humor never changed. Wars were waged, the internet was invented, and a robot had rolled on the surface of Mars. And in Afghanistan, we were still telling Mullah Nasruddin jokes. Did you hear about the time Mullah had placed a heavy bag on his shoulders and was riding his donkey? I said. No. Someone on the street said, "Why don't you put the bag on the donkey?" And he said, "That would be cruel. I'm heavy enough already for the poor thing." We exchanged Mullah Nasruddin jokes until we ran out of them and we fell silent. Amir Agha, Farid said, startling me from near sleep. Yes. Why are you here? Why are you really here? I told you. For the boy, he said. For the boy, I said. Farid shifted on the ground. It's hard to believe.
Sometimes I myself can hardly believe I'm here, I said.
No, he said. What I mean to ask is, why that boy? You come all the way from America for a Shia?
That killed all the laughter in me and the sleep.
I'm tired, I said. Let's just get some sleep.
Farid's snoring soon echoed through the empty room. I stayed awake, hands crossed on my chest, staring into the starlit night through the broken window, and thinking that maybe what people said about Afghanistan was true. Maybe it was a hopeless place.
A bustling crowd was filling Ghazi Stadium when we walked through the entrance tunnels. Thousands of people milled about the tightly packed concrete terraces. Children played in the aisles and chased each other up and down the steps. The scent of garbanzo beans in spicy sauce hung in the air, mixed with the smell of dung and sweat. Farid and I walked past street peddlers selling cigarettes, pine nuts, and biscuits. A scrawny boy in a tweed jacket grabbed my elbow and spoke into my ear, asked me if I wanted to buy some sexy pictures.
Very sexy, Aga, he said, his alert eyes darting side to side, reminding me of a girl who, a few years earlier, had tried to sell me crack in the Tenderloin district in San Francisco. The kid peeled one side of his jacket open and gave me a fleeting glance of his sexy pictures. Postcards of Hindi movies showing doe-eyed, sultry actresses fully dressed in the arms of their leading men.
So sexy, he repeated.
Nay, thanks, I said, pushing past him.
He gets caught, they'll give him a flogging that will waken his father in the grave, Farid muttered. There was no assigned seating, of course, no one to show us politely to our section, row, aisle, and seat. There never had been, even in the old days of the monarchy. We found a decent spot to sit, just left of midfield, though it took some shoving and elbowing on Farid's part. I remembered how green the playing field grass had been in the 70s when Baba used to bring me to soccer games here. Now, the pitch was a mess. There were holes and craters everywhere, most notably a pair of deep holes in the ground behind the south end goalposts. And there was no grass at all, just dirt. When the two teams finally took the field, all wearing long pants despite the heat, and play began, it became difficult to follow the ball in the clouds of dust kicked up by the players. Young, whip-toting talibs roamed the aisles, striking anyone who cheered too loudly. They brought them out shortly after the halftime whistle blew. A pair of dusty red pickup trucks, like the ones I had seen around town since I'd arrived, rode into the stadium through the gates. The crowd rose to its feet. A woman dressed in a green burqa sat in the cab of one truck, a blindfolded man in the other. The trucks drove around the track, slowly, as if to let the crowd get a long look. It had the desired effect. People craned their necks, pointed, and stood on tiptoes. Next to me, Farid's Adam's apple bobbed up and down as he mumbled a prayer under his breath. The red trucks entered the playing field and rode toward one end in twin clouds of dust, sunlight reflecting off their hubcaps. A third truck met them at the end of the field. This one's cab was filled with something, and I suddenly understood the purpose of those two holes behind the goalposts. They unloaded the third truck. The crowd murmured in anticipation.
Do you want to stay? Farid said gravely.
No, I said. I had never in my life wanted to be away from a place as badly as I did now.
But we have to stay, I said.
Two talibs with Kalashnikovs slung across their shoulders helped the blindfolded man from the first truck, and two others helped the burqa-clad woman. The woman's knees buckled under her and she slumped to the ground. The soldiers pulled her up and she slumped again. When they tried to lift her again, she screamed and kicked. I will never, as long as I draw breath, forget the sound of that scream. It was the cry of a wild animal trying to pry its mangled leg free from the bear trap. Two more talibs joined in and helped force her into one of the chest-deep holes. The blindfolded man, on the other hand, quietly allowed them to lower him into the hole dug for him. Now, only the accused pair's torsos protruded from the ground. A chubby, white-bearded cleric, dressed in gray garments, stood near the goalposts and cleared his throat into a handheld microphone. Behind him, the woman in the hole was still screaming. He recited a lengthy prayer from the Quran, his nasal voice undulating through the sudden hush of the stadium's crowd. I remembered something Baba had said to me a long time ago. Piss on the beards of all those self-righteous monkeys. They do nothing but thumb their rosaries and recite a book written in a tongue they don't even understand. God help us all if Afghanistan ever falls into their hands. When the prayer was done, the cleric cleared his throat. Brothers and sisters, he called, speaking in Farsi, his voice booming through the stadium. We are here today to carry out Sharia. We are here today to carry out justice. We are here today because the will of Allah and the word of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, are alive and well here in Afghanistan, our beloved homeland. We listen to what God says and we obey because we are nothing but humble, powerless creatures before God's greatness. And what does God say? I ask you, what does God say? God says that every sinner must be punished in a matter befitting his sin. Those are not my words, nor the words of my brothers. Those are the words of God. He pointed with his free hand to the sky. My head was pounding and the sun felt much too hot. Every sinner must be punished in a manner befitting his sin, the cleric repeated into the mic, lowering his voice, enunciating each word slowly, dramatically. And what manner of punishment, brothers and sisters, befits the adulterer? How shall we punish those who dishonor the sanctity of marriage? How shall we deal with those who spit in the face of God? How shall we answer those who throw stones at the windows of God's house? We shall throw the stones back. He shut off the microphone. A low-pitched murmur spread through the crowd. Next to me, Farid was shaking his head. And they call themselves Muslims, he whispered. Then a tall, broad-shouldered man stepped out of the pickup truck. The man's sparkling white garment glimmered in the afternoon sun. The hem of his loose shirt fluttered in the breeze, his arms spread like those of Jesus on the cross. He greeted the crowd by turning slowly in a full circle. When he faced our section, I saw he was wearing dark round sunglasses like the ones John Lennon wore. That must be our man, Farid said. The tall Talib with the black sunglasses walked to the pile of stones they had unloaded from the third truck. He picked up a rock and showed it to the crowd. The noise fell, replaced by a buzzing sound that rippled through the stadium. I looked around me and saw that everyone was tsking. The Talib, looking absurdly like a baseball pitcher on the mound, hurled a stone at the blindfolded man in the hole. It struck the side of his head. The woman screamed again. The crowd made a startled, "Oh!" sound. I closed my eyes and covered my face with my hands. The spectators, "Oh!" rhymed with each flinging of the stone, and that went on for a while. When they stopped, I asked Farid if it was over. He said no. I guess the people's throats had tired. I don't know how much longer I sat with my face in my hands. I know that I reopened my eyes when I heard people around me asking, "Mord? Mord? Is he dead?" The man in the hole was now a mangled mess of blood and shredded rags. His head slumped forward, chin on chest. The Talib in the John Lennon sunglasses was looking down at another man squatting next to the hole, tossing a rock up and down in his hand. The squatting man had one end of a stethoscope to his ears and the other pressed on the chest of the man in the hole. He removed the stethoscope from his ears and shook his head no at the Talib in the sunglasses. The crowd moaned. John Lennon walked back to the mound. When it was all over, when the bloodied corpses had been unceremoniously tossed into the backs of red pickup trucks, separate ones, a few men with shovels hurriedly filled the holes. One of them made a passing attempt at covering up the large bloodstains by kicking dirt over them. A few minutes later, the teams took the field. Second half was on the way. Our meeting was arranged for 3 o'clock that afternoon. The swiftness with which the appointment was set surprised me. I had expected delays, a round of questioning at least, perhaps a check of our papers. But I was reminded of how unofficial even official matters still were in Afghanistan. All Farid had to do was tell one of the whip-carrying Talibs that we had personal business to discuss with the man in white. Farid and he exchanged words. The guy with the whip then nodded and shouted something in Pashto to a young man on the field, who ran to the south end goalposts where the Talib in the sunglasses was chatting with the plump cleric who had given the sermon. The three spoke. I saw the guy in the sunglasses look up. He nodded, said something in the messenger's ear. The young man relayed the message back to us. It was set then, 3 o'clock. Farid eased the Land Cruiser up the driveway of a big house in Wazir Akbar Khan. He parked in the shadows of willow trees that spilled over the walls of the compound located on Street 15, Sarake Mehmana, Street of the Guests. He killed the engine and we sat for a minute, listening to the tink-tink of the engine cooling off, neither one of us saying anything. Farid shifted on his seat and toyed with the keys still hanging from the ignition switch. I could tell he was readying himself to tell me something. "I guess I'll wait in the car for you," he said finally, his tone a little apologetic. He wouldn't look at me. "This is your business now. I patted his arm. "You've done much more than I've paid you for. I don't expect you to go with me," I said. But I wished I didn't have to go in alone. Despite what I had learned about Baba, I wished he were standing alongside me now. Baba would have busted through the front doors and demanded to be taken to the man in charge, piss on the beard of anyone who stood in his way. But Baba was long dead, buried in the Afghan section of a little cemetery in Hayward. Just last month, Suraya and I had placed a bouquet of daisies and freesias beside his headstone. I was on my own. I stepped out of the car and walked to the tall wooden front gates of the house. I rang the bell, but no buzz came, still no electricity, and I had to pound on the doors. A moment later, I heard terse voices from the other side, and a pair of men toting Kalashnikovs answered the door. I glanced at Farid sitting in the car and mouthed, "I'll be back," not sure at all that I would be. The armed men frisked me from head to toe, patted my legs and felt my crotch. One of them said something in Pashto, and they both chuckled. We stepped through the front gates. The two guards escorted me across a well-manicured lawn, past a row of geraniums and stubby bushes lined along the wall. An old hand-pump water well stood at the far end of the yard. I remembered how Kaka Humayun's house in Jalalabad had had a water well like that. The twins, Fazila and Karima, and I used to drop pebbles in it, listen for the plink. We climbed a few steps and entered a large, sparsely decorated house. We crossed a foyer, a large Afghan flag draped one of the walls, and the men took me upstairs to a room with twin mint-green sofas and a big-screen TV in the far corner. A prayer rug showing a slightly oblong Mecca was nailed to one of the walls. The older of the two men motioned me toward the sofa with the barrel of his weapon. I sat down. They left the room. I crossed my legs, uncrossed them, sat with my sweaty hands on my knees. Did that make me look nervous? I clasped them together, decided that was worse, and just crossed my arms on my chest. Blood thudded in my temples. I felt utterly alone. Thoughts were flying around in my head, but I didn't want to think at all, because a sober part of me knew that what I had managed to get myself into was insanity. I was thousands of miles from my wife, sitting in a room that felt like a holding cell, waiting for a man I had seen murder two people that same day. It was insanity. Worse yet, it was irresponsible. There was a very realistic chance that I was going to render Soraya a bewa, a widow, at the age of 36. "This isn't you, Amir," part of me said. "You're gutless. It's how you were made. And that's not such a bad thing, because your saving grace is that you've never lied to yourself about it. Not about that. Nothing wrong with cowardice, as long as it comes with prudence. But when a coward stops remembering who he is, God help him." There was a coffee table by the sofa. The base was X-shaped, walnut-sized brass balls studding the ring where the metallic legs crossed. I had seen a table like that before. Where? And then it came to me, at the crowded tea shop in Peshawar, that night I had gone for a walk. On the table sat a bowl of red grapes. I plucked one and tossed it in my mouth. I had to preoccupy myself with something, anything, to silence the voice in my head. The grape was sweet. I popped another one in, unaware that it would be the last bit of solid food I would eat for a long time. The door opened and the two armed men returned, between them the tall Talib in white, still wearing his dark John Lennon glasses, looking like some broad-shouldered New Age mystic guru. He took a seat across from me and lowered his hands on the armrests. For a long time, he said nothing, just sat there, watching me, one hand drumming the upholstery, the other twirling turquoise-blue prayer beads. He wore a black vest over the white shirt now, and a gold watch. I saw a splotch of dried blood on his left sleeve. I found it morbidly fascinating that he had not changed clothes after the executions earlier that day. Periodically, his free hand floated up and his thick fingers batted at something in the air. They made slow stroking motions, up and down, side to side, as if he were caressing an invisible pet. One of his sleeves retracted, and I saw marks on his forearm. I had seen those same tracks on homeless people living in grimy alleys in San Francisco. His skin was much paler than the other two men's, almost sallow, and a crop of tiny sweat beads gleamed on his forehead just below the edge of his black turban. His beard, chest length like the others, was lighter in color too. "Salaamu Alaikum," he said. "Salaam," I said. "You can do away with that now, you know," he said. "Pardon?" I said. He turned his palm to one of the armed men and motioned. Rip! Suddenly, my cheeks were stinging, and the guard was tossing my beard up and down in his hand, giggling. The Talib grinned. "One of the better ones I've seen in a while, but it really is so much better this way, I think. Don't you?" He twirled his fingers, snapped them, fist opening and closing. "So," he said, "inshallah you enjoyed the show today." "Was that what it was?" I said, rubbing my cheeks, hoping my voice did not betray the explosion of terror I felt inside. "Public justice is the greatest kind of show, my brother. Drama, suspense, and best of all, education en masse." He snapped his fingers. The younger of the two guards lit him a cigarette. The Talib laughed, mumbled to himself. His hands were shaking and he almost dropped the cigarette. "But you want a real show? You should have been with me in Mazar. August of 1998, that was." "I'm sorry," I said. "We left them out for the dogs, you know." I saw what he was getting at. He stood up, paced around the sofa once, twice, sat down again. He spoke rapidly. "Door to door we went, calling for the men and the boys. We'd shoot them right there in front of their families, Let them see. Let them remember who they were and where they belonged. He was almost panting now.
Sometimes we broke down their doors and went inside their homes, and I'd sweep the barrel of my machine gun around the room and fire until the smoke blinded me.
He leaned toward me, like a man about to share a great secret.
You don't know the meaning of the word liberating until you've done that. Stood in a room full of targets, let the bullets fly, free of guilt and remorse, knowing you are virtuous, good, and decent, knowing you're doing God's work. It's breathtaking.
He kissed the prayer beads and tilted his head.
You remember that, Javed?
Yes, Agha Sahib, the younger of the guards replied. How could I forget?
I had read about the Hazara massacre in Mazar-e-Sharif in the papers. It had happened just after the Taliban took over Mazar, one of the last cities to fall. I remembered Suraya handing me the article over breakfast, her face bloodless.
Door to door, he said. We only rested for food and prayer.
He said it fondly, like a man telling of a great party he'd attended.
We left the bodies in the streets, and if their families tried to sneak out to drag them back into their homes, we'd shoot them too. We left them in the streets for days. We left them for the dogs. Dog meat for dogs.
He crushed his cigarette, rubbed his eyes with tremulous hands.
You come from America, he said.
Yes, I said.
How is that whore these days?
I had a sudden urge to urinate. I prayed it would pass.
I'm looking for a boy, I said.
Isn't everyone? He said.
The men with the Kalashnikovs laughed. Their teeth were stained green with chewing tobacco.
I understand he is here with you, I said. His name is Sohrab.
I'll ask you something, he said.
What are you doing with that whore? Why aren't you here with your Muslim brothers and serving your country?
I've been away a long time, was all I could think of saying.
My head felt so hot. I pressed my knees together and held my bladder.
The Talib turned to the other two men standing by the door.
That's an answer? He asked them.
Nay, Agha Sahib, they said in unison, smiling.
He turned his eyes to me, shrugged.
Not an answer, they say.
He took a drag of his cigarette.
There are those in my circle who believe that abandoning Watan when it needs you most is the same as treason. I could have you arrested for treason, have you shot for it even. Does that frighten you?
I'm only here for the boy, I said.
Does that frighten you?
Yes, it should, he said.
He leaned back in the sofa, crushed the cigarette.
I thought about Suraya. It calmed me.
I thought of her sickle-shaped birthmark, the elegant curve of her neck, her luminous eyes.
I thought of our wedding night, gazing at each other's reflection in the mirror under the green veil, and how her cheeks blushed when I whispered that I loved her.
I remembered the two of us dancing to an old Afghan song, round and round, everyone watching and clapping, the world a blur of flowers, dresses, tuxedos, and smiling faces.
The Talib was saying something.
Pardon? I said.
I said, would you like to see him? Would you like to see my boy?
His upper lip curled in a sneer when he said those last two words.
Yes, I said.
The guard left the room. I heard the creak of a door swinging open.
Heard the guard say something in Pashto, in a hard voice.
Then footfalls, and the jingle of bells with each step.
It reminded me of the monkey man Hassan and I used to chase down in Shahr-e-Now. We used to pay him a rupiah of our allowance for a dance. The bell around his monkey's neck had made that same jingling sound. Then the door opened and the guard walked in. He carried a stereo, a boombox, on his shoulder. Behind him, a boy dressed in a loose sapphire blue pirhan tumban followed. The resemblance was breathtaking, disorienting. Rahim Khan's Polaroid had not done justice to it.
The boy had his father's round moon face, his pointy stub of a chin, his twisted seashell ears, and that same slight frame. It was the Chinese doll face of my childhood, the face peering above fanned-out playing cards all those winter days, the face behind the mosquito net when we slept on the roof of my father's house in the summer. His head was shaved, his eyes darkened with mascara, and his cheeks glowed with an unnatural red. When he stopped in the middle of the room, the bells strapped around his ankles stopped jingling. His eyes fell on me, lingered, then he looked away, looked down at his naked feet. One of the guards pressed a button and Pashto music filled the room. Tabla, harmonium, the whine of a Del Roba. I guess music wasn't sinful as long as it played to Taliban ears. The three men began to clap.
Wah wah, mashallah, they cheered.
Sohrab raised his arms and turned slowly. He stood on tiptoes, spun gracefully, dipped to his knees, straightened and spun again. His little hands swiveled at the wrists, his fingers snapped, and his head swung side to side like a pendulum. His feet pounded the floor, the bells jingling in perfect harmony with the beat of the tabla. He kept his eyes closed.
Mashallah, they cheered. Shabas, bravo!
The two guards whistled and laughed. The Talib in white was tilting his head back and forth with the music, his mouth half open in a leer. Sohrab danced in a circle, eyes closed, danced until the music stopped. The bells jingled one final time when he stomped his foot with the song's last note. He froze in mid-spin.
Bia, bia, my boy, the Talib said, calling Sohrab to him.
Sohrab went to him, head down, and stood between his thighs. The Talib wrapped his arms around the boy.
How talented he is, nay, my Hazara boy, he said.
His hand slid down the child's back, then up, felt under his armpits. One of the guards elbowed the other and snickered. The Talib told them to leave us alone.
Yes, Agha Sahib, they said as they exited.
The Talib spun the boy around so he faced me. He locked his arms around Sohrab's belly, rested his chin on the boy's shoulder. Sohrab looked down at his feet, but kept stealing shy, furtive glances at me. The man's hand slid up and down the boy's belly, up and down, slowly, gently.
I've been wondering, the Talib said, his bloodshot eyes peering at me over Sohrab's shoulder. Whatever happened to old Babalu, anyway?
The question hit me like a hammer between the eyes. I felt the color drain from my face. My legs went cold, numb. He laughed. What did you think? That you would put on a fake beard and I wouldn't recognize you? Here's something I'll bet you never knew about me. I never forget a face. Not ever. He brushed his lips against Sohrab's ear.
I heard your father died. I always did want to take him on. Looks like I'll have to settle for his weakling of a son.
Then he took off his sunglasses and locked his bloodshot blue eyes on mine. I tried to take a breath and couldn't. I tried to blink and couldn't. The moment felt surreal. No, not surreal. Absurd. It had knocked the breath out of me, brought the world around me to a standstill. My face was burning. What was the old saying about the bad penny? My past was like that, always turning up. His name rose from the deep, and I didn't want to say it, as if uttering it might conjure him. But he was already here, in the flesh, sitting less than 10 feet from me, after all these years. His name escaped my lips. Asif, Amir John. What are you doing here? I said, knowing how utterly foolish the question sounded, yet unable to think of anything else to say.
Me? Asif arched an eyebrow. I'm in my element. The question is, what are you doing here?
I already told you, I said.
My voice was trembling. I wished it wouldn't do that. Wished my flesh wasn't shrinking against my bones.